Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
In this episode, we bring you the remaining interviews from what would have been the Keratoconus Symposium at College Congress. There are four interviews in this single episode, and I hope you enjoy them.
I'm now talking with Mr. Ricardo Vinci Guerra, and we're going to be talking about the pathophysiology of keratoconus and the principles of cross-linking. So Ricardo, thank you very much for joining me today to talk.
Thank you.
Just to start off, I was just wondering if you could, for the listeners, give a basic overview of the pathophysiology of keratoconus.
Yes, with pleasure. So keratoconus is a very complex disease because we are building up new knowledge year by year. So basically, at the beginning, we thought it was just a disease that was caused by genetics and environment, which is obviously true. But we have learned two new things in the pathophysiology. One is that the first hit of keratoconus is probably a change in the corneal biomechanics characteristic. Basically, if you think about the cornea like a balloon, you have one area of the balloon which is weaker that will deform more under the same load, which is the intraocular pressure. And this gets worse and worse with the environment. And the environment can be, for example, eye rubbing, if we want to give an example. But then there are new things, new evidences that are coming, particularly from the work of Rohit Shetty from India. And one of the, let's say, the first words that you read in every single article about keratoconus is keratoconus is a bilateral asymmetric non-inflammatory disease, which actually we are seeing that is not completely true, because we are actually seeing that a lot of people do have chronic subtle inflammation in the eye that is actually causing and getting the process worse and worse.
Okay, that's really, really interesting. So you've mentioned there that there's possibly an inflammatory component to the progression of keratoconus. How has that been evaluated?
So, well, it has been evaluated in many ways. So they have evaluated the cytokines inside the tear level, and they have seen that they were different compared to normal people. But this was not the only thing that they have done. So they have done something in addition to that. For example, they used tears with trehalose, reduces inflammation, and they found that patients with keratoconus using the trehalose were having less progression. Additionally, they also used cyclosporin, and they found that the progression of keratoconus was actually reduced. These are preliminary findings, obviously, because we don't have a strong evidence yet, but I think that these evidences are very interesting.
That's really interesting. I was just wondering if you could maybe walk through with us on a more of a cellular level, what's happening to the keratocytes in keratoconus, and you know, how does cross-linking affect them?
That's another very good question, because in reality, we do not know exactly what is happening in the keratocytes. So we do know that the collagen is organized in a completely different structure in patients with keratoconus. And we also do know that this is causing the thinning and the reduction in corneal biomechanics. We also do know that when we do cross-linking by changing the elastic modulus of the cornea, by stiffening the cornea, that is stopping to progress over time. On the other side, we also do know that when we do cross-linking, we kill the keratocytes up to maybe 300 microns. It depends on how deep the cross-linking goes. And if you kill the keratocyte, some people are also thinking that when you kill the keratocytes, the new population of keratocytes that they come inside the cornea, they might be even different from the first one. And that's the reason why we think that is why cross-linking over time stabilizes the cornea to much more than the normal collagen turnover that is supposed to be around 2 to 3 years. But we know that cross-linking lasts more than that.
You mentioned there the varying depth of treatment with collagen cross-linking. Why can't we do cross-linking if the cornea is too thin?
So the idea of that we can't do cross-linking if the cornea is too thin is getting changed. I think that we should go to the basics of this knowledge. So this knowledge came from the first studies that they did in Dresden University. What they were evaluating is what is the threshold in which we kill the endothelial cells in the cornea. But one of the first studies in which they defined these 400 microns was based on a study on rabbits. So the threshold of toxicity was based on the endothelium of rabbits. So first of all, we have seen in a recent study that was evaluated by actually the son of Theo Seiler, and his name is Theo Gunther Seiler, and they have seen that actually the endothelium of humans is much more resistant compared to the one of rabbits. In addition, there are new protocols. One was published by Mazzotta, and the other one was published by Afezzi, in which they used a different way of cross-linking very thin corneas. So Mazzotta is changing the power and the time. So there is this M protocol in which they basically change the amount of energy used and the time, and that is based on the thickness of the cornea. On the other side, instead, Afezzi is changing just the time. So if you just have a cornea that is thinner, you use less energy. And they have showed that they were able to cross-linking even much thinner cornea compared to the 400 microns we are used to. There is also another option that is using contact lens-assisted cross-linking, in which you basically put a contact lens in front of the cornea. But the evidence that this is as effective as is still not strong enough.
That's really interesting. So perhaps in the future, we may end up doing more cross-linking on patients with thinner corneas.
Yes.
One of the points that I understand is that in patients with allergic eye disease, they actually have an artificially thicker cornea anyway due to epithelial thickening. And in reality, you know, the stromal thickness is, you know, unaffected by that.
Yes. It's also true that when you actually have a patient with keratoconus, or in general in an advanced cornea clinic, I think you should always evaluate epithelial maps, which is actually is a routine in my clinical practice. In every patient with keratoconus, or every patient with refractive surgery or pre-refractive surgery, I always evaluate epithelial maps. And you can see some surprises, because it is true that sometimes the epithelium is thicker, but it's also true that allergic eye disease can cause dry eye. And because obviously the tears are uneven, because you can have the papillae. So if that is the case, then it's known that you have a thinner epithelium because of the dry eye. So you cannot give this for granted also.
So with all the benefits of collagen cross-linking in patients with keratoconus, why do we seemingly have such a high threshold for performing the procedure in some cases? And, you know, should we be performing it perhaps in a younger population if there's evidence of progression with a lower threshold?
So I would like to make two comments before this. So we do know that keratoconus represents one of the most common causes of pediatric corneal transplantation, causing about 15 to 20% of all corneal transplants in children. And we do know how dramatic is a cornea transplant for a child. So that is the first thing that we should say. The second thing is that we do have strong evidence that cross-linking is safe in pediatric patients. There is a very recent study, actually, well, it's not very recent, it's last year, but that was published by the group of Siena with Professor Caporossi and Professor Mazzotta, in which they showed that 10 years follow-up of pediatric patients with keratoconus treated with cross-linking. And even if a part of the patient progressed, so 24% of these patients did progress again and needed another cross-linking, none of these patients needed a corneal transplant. And they followed up quite an interesting amount of patients, because there were 62 eyes of 47 patients. So it's a still quite good amount of people with 10 years of follow-up. And I think that if you can say to a child that is maybe 12 or 14 years old that they will never get a cornea transplant in their life, or very unlikely, I think that this is more than all the side effects that cross-linking can have that are very minor, such as They can have some haze, but most of the time the haze subsides. They can have photosensitivity. They can have a temporary reduction of visual acuity. The risk of infection is almost none. It's very, very rare. So if I would have a child with cross-linking of my own, I would cross-link him or her as soon as possible.
And are there any long-term complications or considerations of cross-linking?
Well, long-term complications, I think, are quite difficult because it's a procedure that, if it does cause complication, is in the early follow-up. So I would think about haze, I would think about infections. The only thing that is known to cause is a slight reduction in contrast sensitivity, because some of these cornea, they tend to get slightly hazier. But this is not something that the patient will report you. It's something that we do see with our measurement, but the patient is not bothered by this reduction in corneal sensitivity. Obviously, the cross-linking is, let's say, a young procedure because it was introduced in 2005, 2006. So we have 15 years of follow-up, the most. So obviously, we don't have 40 years of follow-up, but it's unlikely to cause problems when we already have 13 or 14 years of follow-up. So I think we can consider this technique safe in the long term.
Okay, that's a really good tip. You know, with cross-linking, how do you know objectively if the procedure has been a success?
Oh, that's a very big question. Because in a way, what we have done so far is wait and see. Because in the first months after the treatment, everything gets worse. You have bathymetry that is less, curvature is worse, and the aberrations are worse, the visual acuity is worse. And sometimes, you know, when you start your career as, you know, doing cross-linking or you have your residents, they come to you and they say, well, this patient is worse, shall we do another cross-linking? But you know that this is just temporary and they will get better. Then we began using the demarcation line. The demarcation line is this whitish line that you see in the deep stroma after cross-linking. But the problem of the demarcation line is that the only thing we know is that it's correlated with the depth of cross-linking. But there is no evidence that the demarcation line is correlated with the stiffening effect. Indeed, actually, there has been a study that we have done in Liverpool in which we have seen that there is no correlation between the depth of the demarcation line and the stiffening effect. And now we will go to the other argument, because I think that what we should evaluate at the beginning is the stiffening effect. And now this is possible to be evaluated, because there is the possibility to evaluate in vivo corneal biomechanics with pretty much two instruments that are commercially available. One is quite old, that is the ocular response analyzer, that is not very good to evaluate the change in biomechanics after cross-linking, but the Corvis ST has been shown to be able to see these differences pre and post. So I think that in the first month, that is what you should evaluate, is the stiffening effect caused by cross-linking.
So yeah, I'm familiar with, you know, the measurement of corneal hysteresis in patients in whom we're, you know, measuring IOP as a substitute for measuring corneal thickness to get more reliable results. But do you think that, you know, we could measure hysteresis or corneal biomechanics in order to diagnose keratoconus rather than to evaluate the success of cross-linking as well?
So before answering this question, I have to clarify the difference between corneal biomechanics and hysteresis. Because the problem in the ophthalmology community is that most of the time, hysteresis is confused with corneal biomechanics, and this is not the case. So let's explain what hysteresis is. So if you have a perfectly elastic material, like a spring, the loading and unloading phase, basically if you pull and release the spring, it will go in the same direction and in the same velocity. So this is a perfectly elastic object. If you have a viscous object, such as honey, for example, the quicker you apply the load, the more you will have resistance. And something that is in between elastic and viscous that we know, except of the cornea, is the memory foam matrices. So we know that they are elastic, but the stronger we push on them, the more they resist. So that is the same thing. So why we're speaking about memory foam? Because hysteresis is the difference between the loading and the unloading phase. So basically, you're just evaluating the viscoelasticity of the cornea. But this is not is one just one parameter of corneal biomechanics. So when you evaluate corneal biomechanics, the reason why we associate this with corneal biomechanics is because the ocular response analyzer was giving a measurement of hysteresis, which was not pure hysteresis, which is quite long to explain. And if you want, we can go more in details. But basically, that was an index. And then going to your question, if we can use this to diagnose keratoconus, the answer is yes. We demonstrated this in many papers. We published a paper with the Corvis Biomechanical Index, that is an index that was created just based on pure biomechanics. And we have shown that was very sensitive and specific alone to diagnose keratoconus without the aid of tomography. So an air puff on its own can have a sensitivity and specificity of more than 95% to diagnose keratoconus. But obviously, we know that tomography is of foremost importance. So we cannot avoid using tomography. And we did another index that is called TBI, Tomography Biomechanical Index, that is combining with a very sophisticated artificial intelligence all the parameters of tomography of the Pentacam and the parameters of biomechanics with the Corvis to create a combined index that has been shown not only to be able to diagnose keratoconus, but to diagnose subclinical keratoconus. How we define subclinical keratoconus? So we know that probably unilateral keratoconus does not exist. And this is not something that I think, but is based on the global consensus of keratoconus enectatic disease. If unilateral keratoconus does not exist, we also do know that our patients that have one eye that looks normal and the other eye is completely abnormal. So our quest was to try to see if with these advanced indexes, we were able to diagnose these eyes that look normal, but we think that they are abnormal. And we proved this, that a lot of these eyes that were looking normal, they are indeed abnormal.
Okay. Well, you know, just one final question, if that's okay. You know, based on the points that we've talked about, you know, with altered biomechanics, would you have any advice for clinicians who are seeing patients with keratoconus?
In general, I would give two main advices. So the first one is that we should not give for granted that patient would or would not progress. So we should be based on evidence. So there is evidence, for example, that patients that are lower than 18 years old, they almost progress all the time, which means that we should cross-link them as soon as possible, if not when they present to my clinic. For example, if I have a pediatric patient, I don't wait for progression. I cross-link them as soon as possible. But on the other side, I would like to give an advice to my colleagues that think that keratoconus is not progressing after 35 or 40 years old. This is not true. We are actually going to publish very soon a paper in which we are showing the outcomes of corneal collagen cross-linking in patients older than 40 years old. And we had a patient that was 67 that were progressing with keratoconus. So it is rare, but some of these patients do progress when they are old.
Well, Ricardo, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been really enjoyable and I've learned a lot.
Thank you. Thank you. That was a pleasure.
So now I'm joined by Mr. Damien Lake, a consultant ophthalmologist who specialises in the anterior segment. He works at the East Grinstead Hospital. So Damien, thank you very much for joining me today to talk about surgical techniques in keratoconus. So one of my first questions would be that, you know, do you have a cutoff in regards to corneal thickness for performing cross-linking? You know, if so, you know, what's your approach to managing a patient with, you know, progressive keratoconus if you can't perform cross-linking?
Well, the first thing to remember is with collagen cross-linking for the cornea, there are a number of safety parameters that we bear in mind. So the indication for cross-linking in the first place is that the patient has progressive keratoconus. Now, where do we get patients with progressive keratoconus? Well, these are commonly patients who are in their late teens, 20s, 30s, and by the time you're in your 40s, generally the cornea has stabilized. However, that is not always the case. So particularly atopic patients or patients who have a lot of allergic disease who continuously rub their eyes, I have seen ectasia still be progressive in 40s and even 50s beyond. So when I'm considering cross-linking in the adult group, 20s and 30s, I want to know that they've got progressive keratoconus. So usually a series of three topographies over time, which suggests that there's progression. Now, that distinction becomes a little bit more ethically grey when you're discussing maybe children, because of course keratoconus is often manifested in the past in adults, but it begins in children, and cross-linking works and other treatment for keratoconus works in the earlier stages much better than it does when you get to an advanced stage. So it's better if we can pick this up in children. And you can see children as even under 10 who have early progressive keratoconus, and it's that group that if we can pick those up earlier, we can do collagen cross-linking and prevent them getting more severe disease by the time they're in their late teens and early 20s. So my indication for doing cross-linking in a child would not lead me to wait until they're progressive, because it's highly unlikely that they're not going to be progressive if they've already got keratoconus changes in their early teens, which is the first thing that I bear in mind. Now, there are a number of measurement parameters that I look at once we've done the corneal tomography. So in our unit, we use Pentacam, but in other units, there are other models are available, and they're just as good for monitoring keratoconus and picking up keratoconus. And what I'm most interested in from a safety point of view is that when we perform cross-linking, we are removing the epithelium, we are soaking the stroma in riboflavin, and then we are irradiating the eye with UVA light. Now, that has been shown in the original studies that if the cornea is too thin, it will damage the endothelium, and then obviously that can have severe consequences for the patient. So our first indication is this cornea thick enough? And it's important to bear in mind that when you're performing the conventional collagen cross-linking, you remove the epithelium. Therefore, it's the thickness once the epithelium has been removed, and there can be some confusion about that. So we make an assumption that the corneal epithelium is about 50 microns. That's probably very conservative, because of course the corneal epithelium is often thinner over a steep cornea. But then that enables us to calculate how thick the stroma is at the thinnest point. And I want to have a corneal thickness at the thinnest point of about 400 microns. Now, there can be some discussion around that, in as much as we can use a type of riboflavin, which is the vitamin B drop that we soak the cornea in. We can use a hypoosmolar vitamin B solution, which will thicken the stroma. So then the question is, well, how thick does the stroma have to be before you use hypoosmolar riboflavin, and what degree of thickening can you get from that? And the answer is that we don't know until we try, basically. So if I have maybe a stroma that's less than 400 microns, I would have that discussion with the patient, because I would have to tell them that you're below the threshold for conventional collagen cross-linking. I can do this modified version of collagen cross-linking, perhaps, but I won't know if I can safely thicken the cornea stroma to a safe level. So if, for instance, a patient had a calculated stroma thickness of 350 microns, I may apply hypoosmolar riboflavin for half an hour, and then I would remeasure the corneal thickness. If it's above 400 microns, I can safely proceed on to do corneal collagen cross-linking. However, in some people, it will not thicken above 400 microns, and therefore, unfortunately, I'd have to tell them that it's not safe to proceed, and we'd have to abandon the procedure, which has got effects on the patient, because of course we will have debrided the cornea, it will be painful afterwards, there is a risk of infection, and it may be of no benefit to them. So, but that discussion needs to be had prior to any surgery so that they're fully informed of the risks and the potential at that point. There is also the measurement of the curvature. We do know that collagen cross-linking works better in corneas that are less steep and less curved. So under 55 diopter maximum K reading will do better than above 55 diopter K reading. I wouldn't consider it a complete exclusion to do corneal collagen cross-linking on a steeper cornea. However, there is an increased risk of failure, and there is an increased risk of complications such as infiltrates if you do a steeper cornea with collagen cross-linking. But the most important parameter for me is the thickness, so that we protect the endothelium.
In a patient where you can't go ahead with the cross-linking procedure, what's your next step?
Again, there's a different algorithm in your mind depending on various factors at that stage. If you've got progressive keratoconus in an adult and they're too thin to achieve collagen cross-linking safely, the next thing I want to know is whether they have good vision, and how, because if they do not have good vision and they're not a candidate for collagen cross-linking and they can't tolerate a contact lens, then their next step is likely to be a cornea transplant, whether that be a deep lamella graft or a full thickness graft. If they are an adult and they're too thin for collagen cross-linking, but their vision is good in contact lens wear, then they would just continue with the contact lens wear, and we see how things goes. See how things go in the future. If they're a child and too thin for collagen cross-linking and vision is good, then we would again need to just monitor the situation. If their vision is poor, then they would need a trial of contact lens before we decided on the big step of doing a deep lamella corneal transplant.
That, you know, seems very, very logical. I was wondering, you know, could you explain how surgical approaches for corneal transplantation in the context of keratoconus have changed in recent years?
Well, there are a number of changes over the time that I've been practicing ophthalmology. I mean, it would have been common prior to this, so that the revolution with collagen cross-linking and the use of intracorneal rings and the degree of laser on the cornea have meant that there are more procedures available that we can do for early keratoconus. In the past, it normally would have been a case of fitting hard contact lenses early, and if that sufficed, then that would be the treatment for the rest of their lives. If they develop scarring and progression, then we would go on and do a full thickness or penetrating keratoplasty. But certainly over the last 20 years, 25 years, we've developed a more bespoke treatment algorithm for treating patients with keratoconus. So for those who are visually impaired, can't tolerate contact lenses, out with the indications for collagen cross-linking intracorneal rings, then we would do a deep anterior lamella keratoplasty. And what that means is that in keratoconus, we know that the layers that are affected in the disease are the epithelium, Bowman's membrane, stroma. So we would aim to remove all of those layers and replace those layers with a donor. The most accurate way to do that is to use something called a big bubble technique. The big bubble was developed by Fogler and Anwar and Teichmann in the past. And we aim to split the plane between the posterior stroma and the Descemet's membrane. And we do that by using a blunt cannula called a Fogler cannula, which has a small opening on the inferior side of the cannula so that the air is forced posteriorly, hence separating Descemet's membrane from the posterior stroma. We usually make a peripheral cut in the stroma down to about 400 microns. It can be deeper depending on the peripheral thickness superiorly. The cannula is then pushed forward into the deep stroma in the mid periphery of the cornea, and an injection of 1 mL to 2 mL of air quite forcefully, and you would aim to produce a big bubble separating the desmase and stroma at approximately up to about 8.5 millimetres in the cornea. Now that plane then allows you to safely get into the bubble. Once you get into the bubble, you can inject viscoelastic, which helps separate the stroma from the desmase membrane further, and it makes the dissection quicker and also more accurate, so that you're not leaving a great deal of posterior stroma attached to desmase, which used to be the issue with more manual techniques which we used in the past, because a greater degree of stroma that's left on the desmase membrane once the dissection has been performed, that affects the optical quality. We certainly know that more than 100 microns of stroma left on the posterior, of the posterior stroma left on the desmase membrane, will adversely affect the visual quality. And so this technique enables us to bare desmase and give a much cleaner dissection. The other issues are around the tools that we use to perform keratoplasty, like femtosecond lasers. Femtosecond laser is a tool which is very common in ophthalmology now, and particularly in anterior segment surgery. It helps to separate planes of tissue. So the femtosecond laser can create a very accurate side cut for the keratoplasty, and also a very accurate depth of the dissection, which then enables us to pass the foveal cannula into the posterior stroma to effect a big bubble. Now, some of the advantages of the femtosecond laser are that you get a much more accurate side cut. You can alter the shape of the side cut so that you create a sort of lock and key effect. So there's a greater surface area of apposition between the host and the donor stroma, which therefore enables a greater healing response and a stronger wound. The evidence is out on whether that decreases the amount of astigmatism and whether it's a great advantage optically for the patient in the long term. For the healthcare system itself, unfortunately, it's more expensive, which prohibits its use. For the surgeon, it tends to take less time in my experience than using a manual method. And it also increases the likelihood that you'll get a big bubble. One of the disadvantages of the big bubble is it's a sort of all or nothing approach. If the big bubble works, it creates a great surgical plane. If it doesn't work, it will tear desmase membrane, and then it will lead you to require to do a full thickness cornea transplant, which in the long term has got a greater risk of rejection than a deep lamella keratoplasty, because you're transplanting the endothelium as well. And I think that that's the main advantage of it, really, the femtosecond laser.
Are there any other, you know, main advantages of performing a DALK over a PK?
The main advantages are, number one, it's a much easier, repeatable procedure. So if the dissection goes well in the original operation and you get a clean dissection between desmase membrane and the stroma, say, for instance, in the future you get an infection on the deep lamella keratoplasty and it scars, and then you need to replace that because it's optically significant, it's much easier to do a repeat deep lamella keratoplasty by simply removing that previous keratoplasty and using a new donor and stitching it in. The secondary dissection is not as difficult as the primary dissection. And the repeat and the chances of issues with any subsequent deep lamella keratoplasty are basically the same as the original deep lamella keratoplasty. However, we know from graft registries that if you do a repeat penetrating keratoplasty, each graft has a lesser survival than the one previously. Now, that's particularly pertinent in keratoconus patients, of course, because The age of a keratoconus patient requiring a penetrating keratoplasty is usually in their 20s or 30s. Penetrating keratoplasty had great success in the past. So 93% of grafts, I think, on the Australian Graft Registry would survive 5 years. But of course, these patients are in their 20s. So 7% of those will fail. And then the second graft would have a much greater risk of failure. So potentially, in a lifetime, these patients may need 4 or 5 grafts, each one lasting less than the one before, which is a significant commitment by the patient and the health service in time and expense for them throughout their lifetime. And anyone who runs a corneal transplant surgery will have and that's been doing corneal transplantations for a long period of time will have patients who have had 4 or 5 or more cornea transplants because they had a penetrating keratoplasty in the past. So that's the main advantage of a deep lamellar keratoplasty, is the decreased risk of failure, and that if you do have to repeat the graft, it's much easier to do so on a deep lamellar graft than on a PK.
I mean, it sounds like we've made massive advances in the way that we're performing surgery for patients with keratoconus, even in just the last 4 or 5 years. You know, one other thing I was thinking is that, you know, with regards to cataract surgery, do you have any specific considerations when you're performing cataract surgery in patients with keratoconus?
Yes. Keratoconus patients are not simple, or may not be simple, if they've got cataracts at the same time as well. The planning and the discussion preoperatively is much more convoluted and involved. The first thing to note is whether a patient is wearing a hard contact lens and whether they will continue to wear a hard contact lens after cataract surgery. If they're a hard contact lens wearer and they're going to continue to wear a hard contact lens after cataract surgery, you do not want to implant a toric intraocular lens into that patient, because the toricity on the lens will become manifest if they're wearing a hard contact lens. The second consideration is the degree of keratoconus that's in the cornea at the time and the type of keratoconus, how irregular the cornea is. Because even with if they have a fairly regular central cornea, for instance, and that they can wear spectacle lenses preoperatively and get a relatively good best spectacle corrected visual acuity, it would indicate that most of their astigmatism is regular. And therefore, they may be a candidate for a toric lens if they've got low astigmatism. If, however, they have not been able to correct with a pair of spectacles because their cornea is too irregular, it would indicate that the majority of their corneal astigmatism is irregular, and they will not do well with a toric intraocular lens, and they will be contraindicated for a toric intraocular lens. Now, with keratoconic patients, their induced myopia and astigmatism is not just due to the increased steepening of the cornea. They also have often greater axial lengths, and you also need to look at the white to white on keratoconic patients. And the reason for doing so is to assess whether they will be a candidate for a toric intraocular lens or not. If they've got an enlarged white to white, so above 12.5 millimeters, then they've got an increased risk that the toric lens will rotate postoperatively, which will cause you huge problems in a keratoconic patient, because it's not something that will easily be corrected with a hard contact lens. They'll need a bitoric hard contact lens to correct that. So you need to screen out those patients, and anyone that's close to 12.5 white to white will I would use a capsular tension ring to try and prevent any rotation as well. They need to be pre-warned that their chances of a refractive surprise are much higher than a standard patient. So if you look in the planning process, the first question will be, you know, which K readings will I use and which instrument will I use? There's great debate about that in the literature, and often contradictory results, which would indicate that there's no one answer and no great answer. For myself, I tend to use the central Pentacam readings rather than the IOL, rather than my optical biometry readings. But either way, the degree of error is much higher with keratoconic patients. The next question is which formula do we use? I think that the evidence so far would suggest that the SRK2 would be slightly better, particularly for the more advanced keratoconics. However, again, the variability is much higher no matter which formula you are using, and the likelihood of getting a hyperopic outcome is much higher as well. So the patients need to be pre-warned that's more likely for them. From an operative technique point of view, the main consideration is, will I get a good view to do the surgery? So when I'm pre-assessing them in the clinic, I look to see if there's any corneal scarring. Is there going to be a lot of distortion? So will I be able to do the cataract surgery in the first place? If it's not possible because there's too much scarring, then it may be combined with a deep lamellar keratoplasty or an anterior lamellar keratoplasty in the first instance. Or there have been case reports described of actually doing the cataract surgery with a hard contact lens applied to the cornea to decrease distortions to give you a better view into the anterior chamber, which could be useful. The other thing to think about is, where am I going to place my corneal wound at the time of cataract surgery? For two reasons. Number one, the corneal wound is more likely to leak postoperatively in keratoconic patients. You're less likely to have a useful stromal hydration, which will keep the wound closed. So you may have to use a suture at the time of surgery. The number two is, how is that going to affect this astigmatism? For myself, I tend to always place it temporally and to go for a mini scleral tunnel in patients with keratoconus to affect the cornea less. But you've got, again, much more chance of affecting the corneal astigmatism if you've got a corneal wound rather than a more posterior wound in keratoconic. And be prepared that you will need a corneal stitch at the conclusion of surgery. For people who've got a degree of regular astigmatism with low maximum K readings, so below, say, 55 diopters, who've got a small white to white, less than 12.5 millimetres, who do not have a very long axial length, so 25 millimetres or above, I would consider a toric lens if they're not going to be a hard contact lens wearer postoperatively. But that's after a big discussion with them, because obviously there's going to be increased risks in that strategy than going for a plain monofocal and correcting with spectacles postoperatively. It's also relevant to think what's going to happen in the future. So if this is a young patient that may still be progressive in the future, then obviously it's not worthwhile putting a toric lens in. They have to show stability of their cornea over time. They have to be an older patient. We have to be sure also that this patient is unlikely to need a cornea graft in the future. Because if I put a toric lens into the capsule bag, that's obviously much more difficult to remove. And if this patient needs a cornea transplant in the future, that toric lens and the toricity on that lens will not match any astigmatism on the cornea transplant. So I'll be in a situation where I've got to try and remove a toric lens from a capsular bag, which isn't advantageous at all. So I also make a judgment as to whether this patient is stable and that they're never going to need a cornea transplant in the future.
You know, just one final question now. We've just touched briefly on lenses, toric lenses, monofocal lenses, but are there any, you know, other IOLs, you know, either available now or coming in the future that might be useful in patients with keratoconus?
I think, well, lens technology in general is very interesting at the moment. And we're probably standing on a threshold of a degree of revolution in intraocular lenses. At the moment, we all very commonly use acrylics and silicone lenses, etc. The issues with keratoconus are that we can correct their spherical equivalent. We can correct their astigmatism to a degree if it's regular. What we can't correct is their irregular astigmatism and aberrations. Now, in the future, there are studies at the present by Professor Billet and others looking at using lasers to alter the shape of intraocular lenses by micro-lathing the ultraviolet coating on intraocular lenses. Now, that has got the potential in the future of correcting not only the sphere and cylinder, but also maybe the higher order aberrations to a degree, which is very pertinent in keratoconic patients because their optical quality is affected not just by the myopia and astigmatism, but also the, you know, the massive aberrations that they live with daily. So I think in the future, hopefully we will be able to affect those and improve the quality of life of keratoconic patients.
Okay, well, Damien, thank you so much for joining me today. That was really interesting.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm now speaking with Dr. Trisit Dave, a specialist optometrist who is an expert in contact lenses. We're going to be speaking about how contact lenses can improve patient vision in keratoconus. So Trisit, thank you very much for joining me today to speak. One of the first things I want to ask you really is, at which stage do we use contact lenses in keratoconus over glasses?
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. Of course, keratoconus, first of all, is a condition which causes thinning to the cornea, and that corneal shape is modified from being very asymmetric. That asymmetry is what prevents glasses from not correcting the patient's vision properly. And that's because keratoconus induces things like high-order aberrations. And so contact lenses act as a medium to create a new surface at the front of the eye, and behind this come the tears, which correct those imperfections, thereby making the shape of the front of the eye more regular so that light can be focused more appropriately on the retina.
Okay. You know, up until recently, the different types of contact lenses used in keratoconus were just buzzwords. Could you maybe give an overview of the different types of contact lenses that we prescribe in keratoconus and why we might pick one over the other?
So there has been a tremendous amount of development in keratoconic lens design, particularly over the last 3 to 5 years. But in my practice, I tend to have look and match the type of contact lens with the degree of keratoconic progression. And of course, that is primarily related to improving their vision. So the types of lenses that we have available are soft contact lenses, not your regular type of daily disposables, although if visual acuity is particularly good, even in glasses, then soft contact lenses, of course, can be fitted for these patients. But there are soft lenses that have been designed for keratoconus, and those are generally only useful at the very early stages of keratoconus. And certainly by the time patients come to see me, I rarely use soft contact lenses for the management of vision in keratoconus. The next stage of lenses are rigid gas permeable lenses, which are around, which fit within the corneal area, so they're corneal lenses, and they're around about up to 10, 11 millimetres in diameter as a maximum. And those lenses, again, these days, the amount of lenses I use for keratoconus in this variety is diminished. But they were used very, very successfully for the correction of vision in keratoconic lenses for kind of moderate levels of keratoconic eye disease. We also have hybrid lenses where there is a periphery of the contact lens is made from a soft lens material, and the centre of the contact lens is made of a rigid lens material. The reason why these tend to be preferred by patients, at least, is because they're so much more comfortable. A rigid gas permeable lens will move around by 2-3 millimeters on the eye, and of course they sit on the cornea, so they cause quite a bit of irritation to patients, particularly for sort of neophyte wearers, people who are new to contact lenses. The interaction with the eyelid and the movement causes quite a lot of a reflex tearing, which does subside after 2 to 3 weeks. But a rigid gas permeable centre is what will allow keratoconic patients to be able to see much, much better over their glasses, reducing things like the doubling, the splitting of vision, which are common symptoms in keratoconic patients. So these days, my kind of go-to lens is actually a scleral lens, and these lenses are much bigger. They do not interfere with the cornea at all. So they bypass the cornea and they rest all on the scleral area. So these lenses are 16 to 20, 21, 22 millimeters in diameter. And they provide exceptional levels of comfort, really good quality vision. And the comfort is although it sounds like these lenses are huge and unlikely to be comfortable, by virtue of the fact that they do not move on the eye, they do not interact with the eyelids, they are extremely comfortable.
That's really interesting. You know, one thing we've established here then is that, you know, patients even with early keratoconus will benefit from contact lenses. Now, are patients who wear contact lenses, you know, scleral lenses, other types of lenses for keratoconus, are they at the same risk of developing contact lens-related corneal ulcers as traditional contact lenses used to improve vision for refractive error?
Statistically, yes. However, one must remember that the incidence of contact lens-related infection, particularly in rigid gas-permeable lenses, is extremely low. So we're talking about 3 to 5 per 10,000 people per year. So, and this group of patients actually are meticulous about hygiene and about looking after their lenses. They understand that these are medical devices. And if only the majority of contact lens wearers were as compliant in terms of lens hygiene, I think the kind of incidence of microbial keratitis that most ophthalmologists may be used to seeing in a hospital eye department could well come down. So compliance is a big issue, and these patients are compliant. But officially, the data is such that there is no difference in this category of lenses compared to other rigid gas permeable lenses. But important to remember that rigid gas permeable lenses per se have the lowest possible incidence of contact lens related microbial keratitis, which is 3 to 5 in 10,000 per year.
So, I mean, I can fully imagine that based on my experiences and interactions with patients who do have contact lens related corneal ulcers. And I think it just highlights the importance of education for patients as well with regards to hygiene in their lenses. And one thing I was wondering is that, are there any contraindications for patients who may want to wear contact lenses?
So the biggest contraindication really is, aside from the patient's ability and compliance, so the biggest medical contraindication for me is really ocular surface disease. We want a thorough lid examination. We want to obviously make sure their tear film is in good condition. And this is particularly important in keratoconic patients, because obviously we don't want our patients rubbing their eyes as much, which is yet another reason why I've preferred to move away from rigid lenses into scleral and mini scleral lenses, because there's no interaction with the cornea. There's only a liquid interface between the cornea and the back surface of the lens. They do not touch the cornea whatsoever.
Sure. You know, one thing that I've just thought of, you know, perhaps a very niche situation, is that, you know, these scleral lenses have significant overlap over the conjunctiva. You know, what if you have the very rare situation where a patient with keratoconus also has a trabeculectomy? Would the scleral lens, you know, interfere with the functioning of the bleb?
That's an extremely good question. And the answer to that is really, it potentially could cause a compression on top of the bleb. However, the manufacturers have created a system whereby we can actually create a micro vault. So the lens can be designed such that along one area of its circumference, we have a sort of notch, a U-shaped notch that's mathematically derived. We can define the radius of curvature of this, and that will therefore bypass the actual trab or the bleb, so that we don't interfere with it in any shape or form.
You know, one thing I wanted to just confirm with you as well is that sometimes you read or are told that, you know, contact lenses reduce the progression of keratoconus by flattening the cornea. But it's my understanding that actually, you know, it actually has no impact on the pathophysiological process that leads to progression of keratoconus. Is that right?
So, absolutely. And that was definitely a myth, that contact lenses stabilize keratoconus. So it's probably worth recapping as to why that's even come about. And obviously, since the evolution of corneal topographic devices, we've been able to get so much more information about corneal shape. And so before this time, when rigid gas permeable lenses, these small diameter lenses on the cornea were used, practitioners also used to fit those lenses relatively flat. So there was some type of molding that happened on the corneal surface. And it's easy to imagine that that would happen, particularly as in keratoconic eyes, the cornea is so much thinner. But most of that molding happens on the corneal epithelium, which clearly is softer, and there is some migration of epithelial cells as well. That is what, when we then measured the refractive error and when we put them on a topographer, the topography almost begins to look a little bit more normalized, and I say that in inverted commas. The reality is this is completely temporary, and once you remove the lenses, that epithelial migration and those subtle stromal changes come back to what they used to be like. So rigid gas permeable lenses do not cause regression. They do not cause any stabilization of the disease process. The keratoconic disease process continues as normal with or without those lenses. But the one thing I think is critically important to say here is that the fitting, particularly of rigid contact lenses, is to be taken with care. We do not want lenses that are fitted flat, particularly if they are causing a type of swirl stain on the corneal surface, because this is a sure sign that that cornea is going to be compromised and is ultimately could lead to some type of corneal scarring.
And one final question now, if that's okay. I was wondering if you could maybe share with us whether or not there are any new exciting technologies or innovations coming around the corner in terms of contact lens technology.
There certainly have been a number of innovations, but before we discuss this, it's worth understanding the key unmet need for our patients. And that need is really the requirement to see far better, particularly at night. With any gas permeable or scleral lens, the tear film underneath the lens corrects the asymmetry. But when I say it corrects the asymmetry and corrects the vision and high order aberrations, it only corrects 90% of them. And that is because the refractive index of the tear film is not the same as the refractive index of the cornea. So where we have a medical condition where there are significantly high levels of high order aberrations, if we correct 90%, that uncorrected 10% becomes a significant number. And that is the reason why, on many occasions, fitting rigid lenses, scleral lenses, doesn't result in patients achieving 20/20 or better. So the innovations then relate in two areas. The first is the manufacturing process. The materials we're using are oxygen permeable. That has been the case, and that is the reason why we've seen a resurgence in scleral lenses. 20, 30 years ago, scleral lenses were made out of PMMA, which has no oxygen permeability. So now we've got really, really good quality scleral lens materials. But the manufacturing process in terms of the ability to make and cut the back surface of the lens using sub-micron precision lathes and CAD design and spline modeling, which results in junctionless transitions on the back surface of the lens, allows us to much better align to the sclera. So that is a key improvement. But it always depends on our ability to measure the sclera so that we can tell the manufacturers what shape to make it in. And changes and innovations in topography devices. So now we have profilometry, we have anterior segment OCT, which gives us very wide field scanning, not just on the corneal surface, but actually onto the scleral surface. We now learn that scleral topography is very, very different, unique, one could say, to every patient. Most scleras are toric. In fact, many are also asymmetrically toric. And that means that the design of the lens is almost unique to every individual if we're going to very precisely align to the sclera. The other area of innovation then is aberrometry, which is not new, but the application to scleral lenses is. So by putting a well-fitting scleral lens in situ and then measuring the residual aberrations using aberrometry, we can now potentially design a customized lens that not only fits much better,
but also corrects those residual aberrations. So has there been work in this area? Well, there has. Certainly back in 2014, there was a publication where wavefront-guided scleral lenses were used to fit 14 subjects who were keratoconic, and they were those residual high order aberrations were compared to the keratoconic group wearing these lenses compared to a age matched equivalent normal sample of subjects, obviously, who didn't have keratoconus. And what they found was the high-order aberrations were reduced significantly in the wavefront-guided scleral contact lens-wearing group, so much so that the high-order aberrations were within one standard deviation of those measured within normal subjects. So that offers great promise. And as these technologies are in existence, these manufacturing technologies are there, but so are the measurement technologies in terms of commercially available devices, it's not going to be long before these instruments are going to be able to talk to the lathes. And so we'll be able to offer our patients customized fitting, as well as significant improvements in their vision.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today. You know, some of those new innovations sound extremely exciting, and maybe you could share some more updates with us in the future.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
To conclude our session, I'm now speaking with Professor Sunil Shah, a consultant ophthalmologist who works at the Birmingham and Midlands Eye Centre. Thanks for joining me today, Professor Shah. To start with, I was wondering whether you could share with us some of your experience in managing keratoconus in children.
I think treating paediatric keratoconus is quite difficult. Firstly, from the diagnosis, then the risk of progression, and then also how you're actually going to achieve the treatment. So looking at diagnosis, obviously there is a lack of topographers in paediatric departments. So you need to be working closely with the paediatric department to achieve this. You do need to believe the optometrist who sees a split retinal reflex, even if it's in a six-year-old. I mean, I think you need to exclude the condition and follow these patients up, rather than just say, no, it can't possibly be, because there are children down at that age who will have keratoconus. I mean, I had 1 week when I was a new consultant where I had an eight-year-old, a nine-year-old, and a 10-year-old all in 1 week. So it's not that uncommon. I mean, what to look out for in these patients? Certainly, we know that it's more common in consanguineous marriages, and there's quite a high incidence, particularly in the Arab communities. So if you go to places like Saudi Arabia, there's quite a high incidence. So that should be one of the conditions. And then the rest of the things are very similar to what you'd look for in an adult. Then difficulty comes in these children that you may not be able to get topography. You know, if they're too young to cooperate, particularly machines like Pentacam do need cooperation for a number of seconds. So sometimes you revert to a placebo device for pediatric patients because it's much quicker. If you can't get a good examination, sometimes you even need to do an examination under anaesthetic. And then finally, treatment. They need cross-linking. They need cross-linking very early on. And I'm I have a very low threshold. So if you have an eight-year-old with confirmed keratoconus, my view is that there's only one way they're likely to go. So if you're going to watch for progression, it needs to be at very short intervals, just 3 or 4 months. You cannot leave these patients for a year. But cross-linking works in the children, maybe not quite as well as in adults, but it works pretty well. So they need to be cross-linked quickly. And if that needs to be general anaesthetic, that's what you need to do. And my tendency is, if I've got bilateral keratoconus in a paediatric patient needing a general anaesthetic, I tend to do bilateral cross-linking.
If you were faced with a referral with maybe an eight-year-old, for example, with keratoconus in front of you, you know, just at their first visit, and they had, you know, clinically significant keratoconus, would you ever list straight away for cross-linking, or would you always wait for a follow-up appointment to look at progression?
I think this is a decision you need to take with the family. You know, obviously it's a shock. If you've got reasonable keratoconus in an eight-year-old, the prognosis, if you don't do anything, is very poor. It's very difficult to do something on the absolute first visit, but there's no reason why you can't see them, talk to them about it, send them off to do some of their own research, and then see them back in a few weeks from what you want to do. This is a personal view that in young patients, I don't think we have the luxury to wait to prove progression. We have seen children who progressed very, very significantly within 6 months.
You know, in terms of a real-life perspective, often we're referred patients by the paediatricians, GPs or optometrists, you know, with a child with reduced vision. And sometimes, you know, as you said, we can't always perform an examination with ease. Are there any, you know, points in the history or examination without, you know, slit lamp examination which may make you consider keratoconus?
Yeah, I think as I said, you have to have an index of suspicion. So if there's a consanguineous marriage, if there's a family history, that certainly points towards it. If they're a badly atopic, then need to look fairly hard. But you need to be familiar with a retinoscope. It's an art which unfortunately isn't used much by ophthalmologists now, but in this group it's essential. If the reflex is split, then there's your diagnosis pretty much there and then.
We're seeing an increasing number from the community of referrals with patients with suspected keratoconus. Do you think that optometrists should be referring all patients with subclinical keratoconus, or do you think they should be perhaps waiting for some evidence of change in refraction or other harder clinical signs of evidence of keratoconus?
Well, I think the change now is that we have a treatment that will stop progression. Original thinking is there's not a lot we can do. We'll put them into contact lenses, so you might as well hold on to the patients as long as you can. The advice now should be the complete opposite. As soon as you have an index of suspicion, either do a topography. You know, a number of contact lens specialist optometrists have topographers anyway. They'll be able to diagnose this. If not, refer into the hospital. I don't think there's a role for sitting and waiting for progression.
You know, now that we're seeing this increasing number of referrals, keratoconus, and having busy keratoconus clinics and service, do you think there's a role of maybe shifting towards a virtual service? And do you think that can be done safely?
We have to make any service that we run safe. So it is a question of us putting adequate protocols together. So, I mean, there's two aspects to a non-hospital service in that there's no reason that an optometrist who does have a topographer cannot run clinics outside of the hospital and do shared care. Whereas virtual service in hospital, yes, I think particularly with the COVID experience, this is something we are going to have to do. Certainly in my hospital, we have had some weeks where we have had up to 50 keratoconus referrals in 1 week. We cannot physically manage this number of patients in a routine clinic. So you can run up a virtual service, which is very much like a glaucoma virtual service. And these can then be assessed by whoever you see fit. So so we have optometrists and nurse practitioners who are going to be doing this virtual service. And then we only see patients in main clinic who need something further. And do we actually need to examine these patients on a slit lamp regularly? Probably not, because they're going to be having optometry follow-up either for glasses or for contact lenses anyway, and this will have to be done at those appointments. But it's just having a pathway which is clear to everybody.
You know, with COVID, do you think that keratoconus patients are going to suffer as a result of the pandemic?
Yes, absolutely. The delay in treatment on patients who are waiting for cross-linking means they will progress. As you know, cross-linking primarily stops progression. You get very little reduction in the cones. I mean, sometimes you get a a diopter or so of flattening, but not hugely significant amounts. And hence, these patients will have a progression of visual deterioration, which we cannot retrieve except with most likely contact lenses. And when they haven't got their contact lenses in, they will be having much poorer vision.
Have you been performing any cross-linking during the pandemic?
We have started now for our semi-urgent patients, but the paediatric patients we've been carrying on throughout the COVID period, so we've classed them as almost an urgent category. In between retinal detachments and penetrating injuries, there we have been managing to do a few.
And just one final question. I was wondering whether you might have any pearls of wisdom or any thoughts or advice that you might want to share with clinicians who see patients with keratoconus, particularly the trainees.
Just be suspicious that patients can have this. It is a relatively common condition. People come in with mild visual loss. This should be one of the things that you think about. There's a easy test to diagnose it, and has major implications for the future if you pick up somebody who's young with keratoconus. I think even in the presence of a relatively normal examination, have an index of suspicion, get a topography done, know how to read the topography, which is a separate challenge, and then refer appropriately, remembering that even if your region does not have cross-linking, there are many other places which will offer it. So the patient should not be deprived of cross-linking just because your hospital does not provide it.
Okay, well, Professor Shah, thank you so much for joining me today. That's been really useful.
You're welcome.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.